Good afternoon, everybody. It is Angie Atkinson, and I'm here with the lovely and talented Dana Morningstar. Dana, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I'm always happy to see you and always happy to have you. So for those of you who are new around here, just to let you know, we do this stream once a week, and usually we go from this channel to Dana's channel. Well, I mean, we alternate weeks. So Dana's channel is Thrive After Abuse here on YouTube. So if you'd like to be part of these streams, make sure that you first subscribe to both channels so that you are connected with and hit the bell notification. So you're connected with those notifications. And then you can also hit the text Angie Live, all one word, to 33222, or Dana Live, all one word, to 22999.
Yes.
And you will be notified a few minutes before we start each time with or without your YouTube notification.
Yeah.
I'm losing it. Point being, when you do start, then you will, when you do send the text, you'll get a live notification from Dana and from myself, depending on which one you send, or if or you can send to both. So whenever we go live together or separately. So, okay.
Yeah.
Usually that, we say that a little bit more clearly. All right. Let me say hello in the chat so that everybody can start talking, because that's a new thing YouTube's doing
yes,
now.
I know. It's so strange.
Okay. Right. Okay. And today we thought we would start off with talking about seven myths that narcissists, that you know, people hear about, people say about narcissists, narcissistic personality disorder. And this is an article that Eleanor Greenberg wrote over on Psychology Today. I really enjoy her stuff. One of the things that she said, which I found interesting, she said, here are a few of the comments that she saw repeated over and over. She said, the narcissists are evil demons who prey on empathic people in order to ruin their lives, which is an opinion. she says, you can't resist a narcissist because they are all incredibly self-confident, sexy, and master manipulators. And then all narcissists cheat. And then the other one was, this one is the one I find most interesting because she doesn't actually readdress this one in the article. And she says, psychotherapy doesn't work on narcissists. These are all comments she saw repeated over and over again. She says, as if they were absolutely true. So we're going to go through all of the seven that she used in her article. But first, I just want to touch on the psychotherapy not working on narcissists thing. In my personal opinion, there is a small chance that it could work. I've just never seen it work, and it would have to require the narcissist to actually want to change and recognize the need for that. And I have not personally seen that happen or heard of it happening. Dana, how about yourself?
Yeah, I would agree. And
it's in theory. My theory is,
yeah, you know, psychotherapy. And I guess it would depend on like what issue that they were in therapy to work on. Mm-hmm. Lots of people get into therapy, narcissists included, for other issues other than themselves.
Yes.
Their relationship with their parents, their trouble at work, their frustration with their kids, whatnot. So yeah, therapy can be helpful to some extent. Therapy isn't really going to it's not going to change a kitten and a porcupine into a kitten.
That is
so
valid.
If somebody, you know, has had a longstanding pattern of being, you know, destructively selfish and lacking empathy, lacking remorse, whatever, then I wouldn't hold on to hope that they're going to have this miraculous 180 turnaround in therapy.
I agree. Yeah.
It just,
yeah. And personally, I think it would require such deep work and such, I mean, it would require the type of personality that they just don't have,
right.
But you know, they would have to find and address their core wound and so on and so forth. And I've never seen it happen. So.
Well, and it's not even addressing the core wound is part of it, but it's
yes.
all of the behaviors they've picked up that are dysfunctional surrounding that's the bigger issue.
Yeah.
And so it's a learning, it's for them, it's learning how to operate in the world in a completely different way.
Yes.
And the main reason that narcissists don't change, it's the level of defensiveness that goes along with it. So for any of us, in order for change to be a possibility, we have to be at that kind of contemplative stage of thinking, okay, yes, there is a problem. I am motivated to work on it. And then being open enough to doing that deep work, that introspective work, that's really difficult for any of us, let alone somebody whose defensiveness is to such a pathological degree. And that's really why the needle doesn't move very far for them. It's that level of defensiveness. There's just resistance to change and resistance to them being the problem at every step.
I could not agree more, honestly. Yeah. All right. Are you ready to go through these 7 myths?
Let's do it.
Yeah. All right. And for those of you who are watching on the replay, I will include the link to this article in the description below. Okay. So the first one is all narcissists are extremely self-confident. And, you know, she points out that what appears to be narcissistic grandiosity and self-confidence is a thin defensive facade. And she talks about it a little more. I would totally agree with that. But let me say this. I do believe there are many, many, oh, so many narcissists who are secretly not confident in themselves, secretly very insecure. And that's why they're so mean and hateful. You know, they step on your head in order to boost their own self-esteem. And, but I do know there's been research done that some percentage of narcissists really are blindly self-confident. So I'm kind of on the fence about that one. I think it just maybe is dependent on the situation, the circumstances, and how they technically became a narcissist, whether it was in childhood because of an attachment issue, or if it was, you know, parenting issues, or if it was to do with their, you know, the acquired situational narcissism, where, you know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. Compensation is definitely a defense mechanism. And so the whole, what seems like super degrees of self-esteem and self-assured and you know, that kind of behavior, that tends to be that form of compensation of really feeling very low and insecure. Because when a person has that healthy self-esteem, they're operating in the world with this mindset of kind of I'm okay, you're okay. Thing. There doesn't need to be this, there's not a power over dynamic and there's not a power under dynamic. That place of I can let you be yourself and I can handle disagreements, you know, and I know that I'm okay, and vice versa. Whereas somebody with low self-esteem, it's again, it goes back to that level of defensiveness of, and for a lot of people that are on that narcissistic side of things, they perceive everything as an attack. Mm-hmm. Any type of boundary that's set, any type of criticism, no matter how constructive, no matter how accurate, it's their way or no way. And if they really are operating from that place of you know, primitive defense defense mechanisms of you know, denial and repression and all kinds of things, you're not sharing the same reality with them.
It's true.
So, yeah, it's a problem.
Yep. 100%. All right. Let's see. Number 2 is all narcissists intend to hurt those close to them. And in her points include things like most of them don't even know they're doing it. They're trying to get their own emotional needs met. Great deal of hurt is just collateral damage and not really their goal. Their goal is to get narcissistic supplies. And I think she means supply, or to defend themselves from what they perceive as just what you were talking about, devastating attacks on their self-esteem and sense of importance. I will let you start with this one if you want to, and then I'll add any of my thoughts after that. What are your thoughts about that? Do they all tend to hurt those close to them or no?
I think it just depends. It depends on the level of awareness they have with their behavior. So sometimes there's intentionality, sometimes there isn't. Yep. At the end of the day, the results are the same, but I think there's a lot of narcissists that do absolutely intend to harm other people. Mm-hmm. And, they are getting their needs met, but because they have no boundaries and they feel it's that level of entitlement to do whatever they want to do as much as they want with whomever they want with no consequences. That's what makes them so dangerous. So it's, we're all trying to get our needs met. Yeah. They're trying to get their needs met, but how they're going about it is very chaotic and destructive.
Yeah. So. And I would totally agree with all of that. And I would just say, you know, I agree that not all narcissists intend to hurt those close to them, right? But I definitely think, you know, it's a spectrum, right? And so I think those higher on the spectrum, those who might be, this is going to sound a little harsh, but I think I've said it before, so I'll say it again. there are some who are less intelligent than others, and those who are lower on the intelligence scale tend to also be less aware of their actions. In my personal opinion, what I've noticed is that some people are just, that's almost just, it's clearly their nature. It's how they know to behave and get through the world. Like you said, get their needs met, whatever. But then there are those who are certainly intentionally manipulating and calculating in every situation. So like you said, it's just, it depends on the situation and the person and their level of awareness. And I would add their level of intelligence.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And, you know, again, I think, you know, on the lower end of the spectrum, you will sometimes see people who might be relatively intelligent, but maybe were raised by a toxic person and don't know better ways to deal interpersonally. Mm-hmm. And because of the fact that they have these tendencies, may not be willing to look beyond that, you know, but that doesn't mean, you know, those are the people who are the ones who are oblivious and who are, you know, just trying to get their own needs met, but then not realizing they're hurting people, you know, so then, but I would tend to say that, especially when the chips are down and we're in that ending part of the relationship where mm-hmm. they start to do the devalue and then the discard, I would say a large percentage probably of the people who get to that point on a consistent basis might be a little bit intentionally hurting people, or at least
that's a very valid point. Yeah, right. I agree. I think there is a lot of intentionality when, mm-hmm. towards the tail end there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of divorce or of the relationship ending or whatever. And this is when you do see a lot of parental alienation and violence, yep. emotional violence, physical violence.
Yep, absolutely. And then myth number three, she says, all narcissists are sexually immoral. She says the reality is that narcissists offer a great deal of standards. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but she knows some who don't ever cheat and who just, mm-hmm. And who don't even lie. And I'll say this, I agree with that point. They're not all that way. I would say a decent percentage becomes a narcissist, you know, a decent percentage of narcissists do cheat, a large percentage probably. But are they all cheaters? No, some of them are ministers and, you know, I know ministers cheat too, but mm-hmm. some of them are, you know, so they're, you know, more maybe religious or they're standing on their ethical pedestal and they're so focused on being quote unquote good that they aren't really, they use that against other people. That's a whole other ball of wax. But I would say, yeah, I agree with that. What are your thoughts on number three? All narcissists are sexually immoral.
Yeah, I would agree. I think anytime there's a statement that's such a like a hasty generalization mm-hmm. of all X, R, Y, yes. it's going to be that right there. That's a logical fallacy because it's Absolutely. Very rare that all X, R, Y. So do all narcissists lie? No. You
right.
know, or do all narcissists cheat? No, like you said, there's different ways. People have different ways of getting their ego needs met.
Yeah.
And narcissists are no exception to that. Keep going. Yeah.
Okay. Will do. All right. Number four, all narcissists are master manipulators. She points out that she has met a few who are good long-term planners and great at manipulating people, but she says they are as rare as great chess players, which I don't necessarily agree with. However, with that being said, we have to recognize that even in the vast amount of people that have come through our two channels and our two, you know, little educational systems or whatever you want to call it, you know, they're from all over the country, all over the world. So it's possible that, in fact, they are not all master manipulators. I don't think they're all master manipulators, but I do think that most people that we would refer to as a narcissist probably have some ability to manipulate, whether it's through I didn't mean to start talking, but I'm just going to really quickly finish up. I meant to have you do this one. Anyway, but I think most people who we would consider a malignant or toxic narcissist, certainly have some manipulation ability, whether they do that through their own like they charm people, or they make people feel sorry for them, or they, you know, guilt people, whatever their manipulation tactic is. It's not always about being fabulous and awesome and charming and beautiful. It's sometimes it's about just being a grind, being a pain in the butt, or making people feel like really bad for you and want to help you in that way. You know, so there are different ways to manipulate a person. And so do they all appear to be con people? No. Do they all appear? Sometimes they look like somebody that you love who is always sad about something, or even if it's not anything to do with them, or, you know what I mean? It doesn't all look the same, but certainly anyone that I would call a narcissist of the malignant type would be some sort of manipulator, if not a master one. Thoughts?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think if we understand narcissism as a blinding, kind of a blinding degree of self-absorption, right? Mm-hmm. That's that person's mindset. When that's a person's mindset, they're going to start justifying every single thing that they do. And they're not open to criticism because they're so defensive. So they're not open to any possibility that the world could be any other way. Mm-hmm. That's the pathological mindset behind it. So when you have that, they're going to be filtering all information incoming and outgoing through that lens.
Yep.
Because of that, they all manipulate. You're not going to have a narcissist that has assertive communication and a solid understanding, a healthy understanding of boundaries and all of these other things. Because if they had all of that and they had functional degrees of all of that, the vast majority of the time, they wouldn't have the problem. So right. I agree. There's this idea that narcissists are so, you know, they're powerful and that they are kind of this master manipulator. The thing with that is it depends on what room you're in, mm-hmm. right? So because it depends on the people in that room, and how skilled they are with being grounded in themselves and understanding what manipulative behavior is. Manipulation only works when we don't see it for what it is. When we see it for what it is, it loses its power completely. It's seeing the wizard behind the curtain. We're like, oh, okay. It's learning how a magic trick works, kind of thing. It loses its mysticism. And that's the thing, how people get, that's why people do tend to think that narcissists are so powerful, and so because they don't understand what manipulation is and how it all goes down. So, but this is why I say it depends on the room that the narcissist is in. If you have a bunch of people because this stuff's not taught, it's very easy to get knocked off base by somebody who is very charismatic or convincing or, but who has very faulty thinking. I mean, this is how cults happen. This is how a lot of, political issues happen. This is how good people take a left turn in life and end up being a part of some really destructive things.
Yeah.
So it's not even, okay, keep going. Keep going. Okay. I'll hold my comments for the end. Okay.
All right. Number five, being all narcissists are vampire-like predators or demons. And she said, you know, they're just people like the rest of us. She says they need other people to validate them in order to maintain self-worth. They're insensitive to the feelings. They lack emotional empathy or very self-centered, blah, blah, blah. She goes on. But she says basically they are not all vampire-like demons or predators. And I'll just let you take it. I agree with the fact that they're not vampire-like demons, but I do see the comparison with the vampire thing. That's all I'm going to say. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I think when people use words like demon, monster, the devil, you know, these kinds of things, subhuman, what they are really referring to, it's that cold, callous level of disregard. Yes. It's that lack of empathy and that lack of remorse. And really, that level of connection and empathy is what makes us human.
Yeah.
So although those words surrounding it tend to be kind of have this like supernatural charge to them, I think that's really what people are talking about, of this is not something that we associate with being human. This kind of behavior, it's so abnormal and it's so problematic and it's so destructive and deadly and without care or concern that it falls into that group of what we could consider evil.
Yep.
You know, I think evil has this supernatural connotation to it, but I don't think it needs to. I think evil, we can say that evil is kind of this malicious destruction.
Yep.
And then the definition fits. Are all narcissists like that? No. Again, it's a spectrum.
Yes.
But I think that there's a lot of them that are. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is the thing, you know, certainly I'm sure there are, just like there are sociopaths and psychopaths who are not murderers, there are narcissists who maybe aren't as, you know, but even then, like I said, there are many narcissists, say, involved in the church or in the, you know, some charities or whatever. There are lots of different reasons that you will find toxic people in good organizations. And then actually it's kind of funny because number six is all narcissists are evil. And you know, she talks about basically what you just kind of said, but she says, you know, they might behave in hurtful ways, but they're not inherently evil, on and on and on. And she says some of them do good deeds, which, okay, that's valid. Some of them do good deeds. There's such a thing as an altruistic narcissist who, you know, gets all of their supply from doing for others. And I don't know about y'all, but if any narcissist ever helped me with anything in my life, what I have found is that they always have requirements or they need to be paid back in some way, whether it's monetarily or not. They have strings attached to any sort of help. And so, you know, are they evil? I mean, what, like you said, I'm not even going to reiterate your points because they were all valid, but are they, do they do good things in the world? Certainly. Do they get their supply? Some of them get their supply from doing good things in the world, of course. But is that how they treat the people at home behind closed doors? Heck no. Mm-hmm. They still abuse people. I mean, those who are, even those who are altruistic, I mean, doesn't make them evil. That again is a whole other story, but what are your thoughts about all narcissists are evil? I mean, do you have any additional ones to add to that?
Yeah. Well, I think the point that she's trying to make and the point that it's worth kind of us discussing is that it's important that we don't idealize or demonize.
Yes, I agree.
Other people. And the reason, and not for any like, you know, politically correct reasons or anything like that, but because so we see people accurately. Because the reality is we all have kind of good and evil within us. We all are all capable of hurtful actions and really good actions. And the reason this is significant is because this can be very confusing for people. We have this idea that we can all spot a problematic or a dangerous or deadly person, and that's not true. Or that really dangerous people are always or abusive people are always abusive 100% of the time. You know, Ted Bundy, horrific serial killer. You know, he used to volunteer at a suicide hotline.
Yep. And so, he was a great stepdad.
He was a great stepdad and a great partner mm-hmm. to his girlfriend.
Yeah.
So Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
There's John Wayne Gacy used to host kids' parties. And that was one of the reasons he flew under the radar for so long, as he was he was very active in his community and people thought really highly of him.
Yep.
So there's just because, you know, Hitler helped the school system and building freeways mm-hmm. and doing a lot of wonderful things for Germany. So we can't look at it. We can't parse out somebody's actions like, well, they did this, so therefore that makes them good. Or we did this, therefore that makes them bad. This is kind of where that overarching umbrella of having boundary standards and deal breakers comes into play, because a person could do 1,000 great things, but if the bad thing is that deal breaker where it's dangerous, destructive, or deadly, then it doesn't matter how many good things they've done. That bad thing means we've got to get some distance, because we can't have a child molester under our roof or somebody who's has a history of violence or, you know, whatnot. So
100%. It's true. And I think, yeah, all valid. The final one that she lists is all narcissists are charming, which we kind of touched on already, but let me see if she has any points we haven't made here yet. She said the charming ones are good at telling stories and make their lives sound fascinating. Of course, that wears off after you've you heard the stories over and over again. And this is an interesting point that she makes that I actually can really relate to personally. The charm wears off or wears thin after you hear them. I said that, tell the same stories over and over again, but realize that they but also when you realize that they actually have no interest in your life and that they use the same techniques. And I would add stories with everyone they meet. I don't know about you, but if you could be a fly on the wall in any narcissist first meeting with a new person, you would know if you have been in any sort of relationship with that person, you would know what their intention is or how they feel about that person based on the types of stories and questions that they tell and ask. Would that be a fair statement for your experiences, Dana, or no?
I'd have to think about that.
Okay. Let me explain what I mean. So with one of my exes, he used to do this little thing where when he first met me, he would flirt in certain ways. One of them was, I would say like, you know, oh, I'm sorry. And he would say, you're going to be, you know what I mean? And then like later after we got married or whatever, I heard him say this to one of my friends and I thought, you know, because my friend didn't know exactly what it meant, but I knew that it was a flirt. You know what I mean? So little things like that, or, they'll have certain stories they told you on the first date and then you heard him again later or whatever. But then maybe you overhear him telling to someone else in the same type of way. And you know, okay, they're trying to impress that person or they're trying to whatever. It's, I don't know, maybe I'm just the thing too much.
No, anyway. I think there's definitely some truth to that. The charm, I guess here's the thing too with charm is charm by definition is superficial.
Yes.
And it's insincere. So charm is never a good thing. So whenever there's a difference between a person being likable and a person being charming. To me, charming is synonymous with like schmoozy and just love bombing, like laying it on too thick, like gushing, right? Yeah. And again, when you see that kind of behavior for what it is, it's a real turnoff. Yeah. Whereas before, when we first see it, we're like, oh, we're confusing that with likability.
Mm-hmm. That's
really, and then we realize, okay. Like probably another example of this would be a car salesman, or at least how it used to be back in the day, where you'd go in and they were really likable and they'd offer you a bottle of water and you sit down and they want, and if you don't know better, you're like, this person really cares about me. And then you realize, oh no, they go through all of the sales training on how to mirror and how to build rapport and how to do this. And it's all manipulative to lead you to the end of buying the car that is, buying a car. It's the same, it's the same thing with any type of manipulative.
It's an interesting article. Oh, sorry. Did you hear me?
Yeah.
Did I lose you? Okay.
No, I'm here. Yeah.
Did I interrupt you? Because I think I might've cut out a little bit or something.
No.
You're okay. Fine. Sorry about that. Anyway, her bottom line, she said, was, look, they're not superheroes and they're not villains. They're troubled, self-centered people with low empathy, et cetera, et cetera. Which I think we agree with most of that. Villains, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I have seen quite a few villains who would be considered narcissists, but I definitely don't think they're superheroes. And I don't think they're anything supernatural either, like we've already talked about on any level. But anyway, okay. Any other thoughts on that before we go to the question that we got by email?
Yes. Okay. So I think for me, the big takeaway from this article is the importance of us kind of turning our focus inward, because it's not about figuring out narcissists, because boy, can people get tangled up in that. I know I did. It's so, when you're learning about red flags and stuff, to think about, okay, well, I don't know, is this person charming or is this likable, or is this narcissists do this, they don't, will therapy work, will it, won't, you know, you can get all kinds of just off the path and stuck in the mud with that kind of thinking. And it helps to turn our focus inward and think about, okay, where are my boundary standards and deal breakers with things? And what do I need in a relationship in order to make it work. We don't need to spend time trying to figure out the narcissist or if they're a narcissist or to what degree or this, that. That's just a big waste of energy. What matters is how do we expect to be treated in a relationship, and where are our boundaries surrounding that? And when we have that clarity, then everything else kind of falls into place. Mm-hmm. And then also it helps kind of back with that manipulative behavior, getting familiar with what manipulative behavior is. And so we're not knocked off balance by it. It's sort of like with, it's one of those things that's not taught, but once it is, that veil lifts, that veil of confusion lifts. It's sort of like with online scams, you know, when that became a thing, people were getting caught up in it all the time, you know, and of course now 15, 20 years later, we look back, and those of us that are on the internet a lot, we kind of laugh because you can see us. It's so easy. We can see scams for what they are. But when those were first a thing, people were getting tangled up with, you know, quote unquote, Nigerian princes.
And, I was just thinking the same thing.
Yeah. You know, people, all the other different dating scams and money scams that were out there. And then information began being spread about basically, you know, we don't need to figure out, we don't need to do all the research to figure out if this person's really royalty or, you know, if this person's really in the army or whatnot. At the end of the day, you just don't give money to strangers on the internet.
Hello.
You know? Yeah. Yep. And figuring out your boundaries around that, that's what will protect you. It's not figuring out other people. It's figuring out what you need to protect yourself.
That is a powerful point. I agree 100%. Yeah. And I think I would like to reiterate the part about boundaries and also self-reflection and self, I don't want to say modification, but I want to say like making adjustments to your self-perception as well as your ability to create boundaries, stand behind them, and to understand your value and self-worth as a human. Because I don't know about everyone else here, but I know that, you know, when you're brought up by a narcissist or a toxic person, you very often come out of that whole deal feeling like not a whole person. And so that definitely can, you know, so all of your points are entirely valid is all I'm saying. Okay. Here's our question we have a question from email from our, what is our email address? It's like, hold on, I'll tell you. It's something Tuesdays. Livestreamtuesdays@gmail.com for those of you who want to send questions in for next week. Livestreamtuesdays@gmail.com. We will both get those emails. Okay, so our one this week, the person who sent the message would like to be referred to as N. Okay. And they say, my question is, how does one handle a smear campaign by a narcissist on social media? The very man who catfished me by posing as a woman decided to stalk and threaten me on other social media apps when I blocked him. He then made very serious false accusations about me on social media and included my first and last name. This has caused me significant distress over the last year. How does one handle this? Thank you. Do you want to start?
Sure. At a minimum, I kind of limited context here. If it's significant damage, I would consider contacting an attorney.
Yep.
Sometimes having an attorney write a cease and desist letter that they then mail out to that person can be enough of a deterrent. Mm-hmm. At a minimum, what you can do to is set up a Google alert for your name, first name, last name, or your business or whatever it is. And then that way you're emailed every time, or this person's name or their screen names or anything pertaining to this incident, mm-hmm. get it emailed. You might need to go to court, small claims court, and then it'll be pretty easy because that's considered doxing and it's a problem. It's illegal. So depending on where they are in the world and all different things, but there can be fines assessed for every time that they continue to do this if there's a court order saying for them to actually stop doing it.
Yeah, no doubt. And I would add, wait a minute, let me stop before I continue. Do you have more to add?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, all right. I would add just from the perspective of your own healing, the person, N says, they're very false, of course, serious false accusations, and it has caused significant distress. So I don't know how much I don't know if it's emotional or legal. So with the legal stuff, everything Dana said, do that. With the emotional stuff, this is what I would say. I would say anyone close to you who questions or doubts you, explain one time only exactly what your side of the story is if you want to. But outside of that, I would not. And if you do explain the story to someone who you think deserves an explanation and they don't understand and believe you, then you might think about taking emotional steps back from that person until this is resolved. And then you might decide at that time whether or not to keep them in your life. The other thing I would add is to recognize that chances are, if this person has done this to you, there's probably someone else in the world who has experienced a similar thing. Being that they catfished you, I mean, if you wanted to be that person, I would not recommend this, but if you wanted to be that person, you could certainly just go public and say, this is what happened, this is what they did, and this is what the truth is. I don't know the whole story and I need to know a little bit more information, but I would agree with what Dana said. If they're affecting you legally or if they're affecting you in any way that is hurting you outside of emotionally, you must take every step that you need to take, you know, get your screenshots, get your proof, contact the authorities and do what is necessary to protect yourself. And also block them on every form of social media and on every other possible platform so that they're not able to reach out to you and contact you. Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Dana?
Yeah. I really like your focus on kind of, them protecting their emotional health during this. And because it kind of goes back to what do we have control over and what do we not have control over? And unfortunately, I think this online forms of manipulation, this is kind of the latest wave of that. And I've been hearing multiple stories from lots of different people about this level of catfishing. It seems also what I've heard a lot of lately is people, well, very similar, kind of getting involved in online dating and then sending nudes and then the person then blackmailing them with them. So you guys, just for real, don't send nudes.
And listen, if you really need to send nudes, don't send any that have any of your identifying features.
Defying features, right. Okay. No tattoos, no face.
Scars.
Yep. Seriously. Because that stuff, if it's on the internet, it's out there forever.
Yeah, like just, I mean, I understand younger people, and forgive me if younger people, it's a different world than it was for us, because we didn't have, thank goodness, we didn't have the internet or the phones and the cameras right here that we could impulsively do that with. Thank goodness for us. But for those, some people here, even, you know, I think even, I mean, the first time that I ever actively had, internet in my house was like 2002, I think. I mean, I had it in my dorm room and stuff, but not my room, my building. I had to go down to the computer lab. But you know what I mean? So anybody who has grown up in the 2000s or whatever probably has always had internet. And beyond that, I think my first smartphone was, I don't know, 2010 or 2012. I can't recall now. Maybe even a little before that. I don't really know. But the point is, thank goodness they didn't have that when we were kids.
For real.
But I agree. That's a valid point.
Yeah.
But even now, you know, from what I'm hearing from people is that even adults, not that there aren't adults before who came after Generation X, but even people in our generation and the boomers and stuff sometimes are doing this or expecting nudes. Or in, you know, whatever. And it's just a different culture today. And in our kids, some of our kids' age groups, my kids' age groups, which is crazy to me, they're sending them really early. And so I just remind my own kids, if y'all have kids, you can remind them of this, taking any nude portraits or pictures of anyone under 18 is child pornography, even if it's yourself. So well, some you might tell you, it's illegal, even if a kid does it to the kid's self. So something to think about. All right, we're going to stop talking about all that. Do you have anything else to add about that? That's not about anything.
I guess I just would reiterate that point of doing what he can in terms of handling that stress as best as he can, getting extra support, kind of circling the wagons, figuring out, okay, who is in your corner as far as a support team, if you have a therapist or a life coach or both, or some sort of support group or family and friends that understand. And figuring out, okay, well, what do you need? What would help you during this time to handle and to try to reduce some of the stress surrounding this? It has exercise, does taking some breaks, having a few 3-day weekends, or possibly everybody's different. So it's kind of figuring out what are you needing right now? What do you think would help?
Good points. Okay, you ready to jump into the chat?
Let's do it. Yeah.
All right. Hello, everybody. First of all, let me thank our amazing mod squad for being here. And then I have a question from Rocio. And she says, or I think it's she, I'm sorry if I'm wrong. Rocio says, why do I feel I'm the toxic one? And I wanted to send him an email. Oh yeah, that looks like a she. I can't tell the picture. Oh, it's okay. My eyes are bad. It's a she. And I wanted to send him an email to apologize. Why do I think I'm the toxic one? Rocio, what I hear in that is that you're doubting yourself. You're doubting your assessment of the relationship, probably because if you're trying to send him an email, you want to send him an email to apologize. My guess is that you either ended it or they did, and now you're somehow blaming yourself for what happened in the relationship. Why do you feel that way? Because they want you to feel that way. They don't take responsibility for their behavior and for the abuse that they like lay on you. For their actively disrespectful behavior. My guess is that this person did something to cause you to feel hurt or offended, and it was a righteous sort of thing you felt. You felt right. You were right to feel the way that you felt, but they have been manipulating you, or during the initial argument, they manipulated you, and now you've had time to think about it, and so you're doubting yourself. And I know this much. During the time that I was in those relationships, I spent a lot of with toxic people. I spent a lot of time trying to fix all the things that were wrong with me, and thinking that maybe if I could just be enough, if I could just be closer to what they wanted, or if I could just, you know, fix this thing or that thing about myself, maybe finally it would be enough for them to finally give me the decent person they promised me in the first place. But no, it never was. So I would just say, trust yourself. Remember, you try to remember the situation accurately and try to recognize where these thoughts are really coming from. What put it into your head that it wasn't their fault and that it was your fault? My guess is that if you look hard enough at that, you will see that they said something to you that stuck in your head, and that you know, with time to think, you sort of expanded on or just continued to believe, even though maybe it's not true. I'm sure Dana has some really good insight on this. What are your thoughts?
Yes. So I'm sorry, what was the question again?
The question was, why do I feel like I'm the toxic one and I want to send him an email and apologize?
Yes. Okay. So a lot of what you're saying, this kind of stuff isn't taught. So being grounded in ourself isn't taught. And so, same with manipulative behavior. Mm-hmm. So when we don't kind of see it coming, it's very easy to get knocked off base. So if somebody's coming at you and they're using a bunch of guilt or pity or obligation, oh, well, like for example, oh, what, you think you're so perfect, you've never made a mistake, or I can't believe you'd walk out on us so easily, or you know what, geez, it's just always about you all the time, isn't it? Or I've tried so much and so for so hard and so long, and you don't seem to care at all. That's the being on the receiving end of that can be very, very persuasive. And for most people, if we're not aware of that's manipulative, it can cause a person to really crumble and cave in and be and plant those seeds of self-doubt of, oh my gosh, I'm not perfect either. And I don't want to walk out on this relationship. I want to try. And oh, I guess, you know, I am the problem, mm-hmm. basically. So that's where that kind of need to feel, where we kind of get pushed into feeling really bad and responsible. But if you can back up a little bit and think, what happened here? Did this conversation just spiral because you set a boundary? You had a question, I don't know, let's say they were hiding their phone or they were texting other women or men or whatever it was. They were doing something squirrely. They were doing something that wasn't okay with you. They said a comment or they did or said something that didn't sit right with you and you brought it up. Is that what started all of this? And then all of a sudden the conversation spun around and now you're the one defending yourself. And then they left and now you feel like, how did we get here? Because that happens all the time. Yep. with narcissists especially, but with dysfunctional communication it's that defensiveness. People get defensive, they spin it around, and they want to get the focus off of them and then onto the other person. And so all of these kind of healthy communication skills, again, not really taught. And but once we have a better understanding of that, it's sort of like learning Tai Chi or something. Like you kind of learn how to bob and weave and flow in that, I don't know, fight, but Tai Chi is not really about fighting. You learn how to move and you learn certain counter moves to shut ineffective communication down. Like that.
That's a really good analogy or comparison or whatever you want to call it. I like that. Is it an analogy? Is it a metaphor? It's an analogy. Anyway, sorry, my inner nerd just came out for a minute. I'm joking. It's totally an outer nerd. I'm all about it. I'm a total nerd. Okay. But I really like the point that you made, and I like the Tai Chi, and I can't remember what the actual Tai Chi is. Not about fighting, right? It's about
kind of the opposite. It's about like energy flow.
Right. That's right.
So
right.
Taking it and using it, or yeah. It's kind of non-combative techniques
with
interactions, I guess.
Love it.
I don't know.
Love
Correct me if I'm wrong. Anybody?
Yeah, because I really don't know. Let us know if we're wrong. Okay. Yeah. But I think it's a really cool, I should look into it more. It's interesting. Anyway. Okay. Do you have another question for us, by the way? Or have
I
you
do. I have. Yeah. I pulled out a few of them here.
Okay.
Chat.
Great.
This is a great point from Michelle, who says, we were talking about all narcissists are charismatic, the comment in the list you read. She said her ex was pathetic instead of charismatic. I wanted to prove to him that he could be loved and have a loyal partner.
Oh, girl, I can relate. That's exactly how I met my ex-husband. Go on.
Yep. So I think it's important to note that's the patheticness, or that kind of falls under that category of guilt, right? So it's pity yep. inducing. Yep. And so then the result for a lot of people, it's that feeling of, oh, well, I just want to love them so much. I squeeze all their broken parts together.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. Yeah. But the problem with that is it doesn't work. And, not only that, but it's exhausting for the person who's trying to do that, and resentment builds up over time. That's best case scenario. Yeah. Worst case scenario is if the person is incredibly manipulative or self-absorbed, you know, narcissistic, that they're going to continue to manipulate that and use that brokenness to get you to make them their whole world.
Yep.
And it might not even really even be real. It's just their way of getting you to do what they want.
Absolutely. And I would add this, on a kind of similar, but slightly different variation of that, something that I found myself constantly attracted to when I was younger were these like bad boy, I hate everybody types. I hate the world hates me kind of people. Mm-hmm. You know, people that called everybody things like drones and zombies and, you know, now they would say something like NPCs or whatever, like everybody's less intelligent than they are. And I would always feel like those people, like on some level, I thought I understood them. And then they would not be who I thought they were. But I would want to do exactly, you know, I would want to show them that people weren't all bad and that they could trust some people, at least me. It was so stupid. But and I don't know if that was me trying to fix something broken in myself that I was trying to like externally fix in other people because maybe I secretly felt that way about the world a little bit. Okay, I totally did probably. But also I would see that and I would see it as, you know, they secretly had low self-esteem. And so I thought maybe if I just helped them, you know, get their self-esteem up, they would be better. And inevitably I would think, oh, finally they're happier and their self-esteem's up. And then, and then bad stuff would happen. But anyway, I guess I would just add that there are variations on that same thing, I think, for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of that's kind of that codependent dynamic. And this was the, I fell into it too, that kind of chronic fixer mode. And I think a lot of it, like you were saying, kind of unhealed stuff within ourselves. I know for me, it was, I subconsciously had this great empathy for people that were experiencing things that I had experienced that, you know, I never got support in certain ways. And so it was sort of this feeling of, well, I don't want anybody else to go through that. So I want to help them with this. And it led to this compulsive need to help and to fix, to where it was sinking me. And I don't really even think it was helping the other person. Or if it was, it wasn't for long. It was just a temporary kind of fix because it was enabling. It wasn't helping.
Yeah.
And, so kind of learning how to have balance in a relationship and having relationships based on mutuality instead of creating a parent child dynamic or a therapist client dynamic or some sort of unequal, you know, caregiver versus a person who needs care kind of dynamic, creating one of mutuality of, yeah, this other person might have some very real things going on, but then finding that balance of, okay, where are my boundaries in this? Where is that line between empowering them and enabling them? And what is my responsibility and what isn't my responsibility?
Yeah. So I would 100% agree with that. Do you have another?
I do, girl. I've got all the things.
Woo! Go ahead. What you got?
Okay. Okay, this is a comment from Mike. He says, yes, making boundaries clear in your relationships is quite a brave and cathartic thing, whether the person or the relationship is toxic or not.
Mm-hmm. That's the truth. I would agree.
And here's a question from Lynn, which I thought was fantastic. She says, narcissism is a spectrum, but they aren't all the same, but are there common denominators?
Okay, so I say this all the time. I think there are several different common denominators, and I think we can look at, in most cases, we can see a pattern of how that starts and all this other stuff, but I will just say it one more time. I think the defining characteristic of, you know, narcissism in itself is not evil or bad or even a terrible thing. Sometimes it just looks like self-esteem, but in the case when it becomes toxic, I think we're talking about someone who is lacking emotional empathy and who acts from that perspective. That's where I could go down a whole list of things that are all the same and common, but I think that is the tipping point. You know, in my personal opinion and experience, not everyone would probably agree with me, but I believe that anybody who acts from a place of empathy cannot actively hurt other people on purpose. In my personal opinion, again, and experience. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree that, common denominators, I think in a nutshell, it's like Angie's saying, it's that it's a problematic degree of self-absorption.
Yes.
And that's on the mild end. Mm-hmm. So yeah, narcissism's on that spectrum ranging from healthy narcissism, which is what we would consider a functional self-esteem. It's that ability to be like, hey, I'm going to get up in the morning. I'm going to impact change in the world. I feel, you know, I why not me? Why not now? Kind of ability that up and at 'em kind of level of energy and optimism and decent enough relationship with ourselves to think that we can set goals and are worthy of achieving them, whatever those goals might be, relationships or, you know, other goals. To pathological narcissism, that where it's that degree of problematic degree of self-absorption, to malignant narcissism, which is dangerous and deadly. So that common denominator with that pathological narcissism is that that problematic degree of self-absorption. And and this is why I think it's so important to flip it around and focus on, well, where are we in all of this? And what do we need in a relationship? Because anybody that has a problematic degree of self-absorption isn't going to be a good relation, a good partner in a friendship or relationship, a coworker, anybody, because they don't have that ability to be team oriented. Mm-hmm. They don't have the ability to take constructive criticism. They are incredibly defensive. They're difficult, and they have a whole host of dysfunctional ways of getting through life. Mm-hmm. So that's right. That common denominator. It's massive dysfunction.
I agree. Malta, I just did, and thank you for the super chat. Okay. And hello, thank you for being here. Okay, so where were we?
I've got another comment here.
Great.
Okay, this is from Critical Mass, who says, mm-hmm. If you're going through intense or high levels of narcissistic abuse, you might notice yourself acting more like a narcissist yourself while still being abused. What are your thoughts about that?
Yep, that's true. For a couple different reasons. Number one, you know, what they call the narcissistic fleas, where you just kind of pick up habits from anyone that you spend a lot of time with. Like I've mentioned before that I caught myself speaking in a way that sounded bullying when I didn't mean to at one point. And I realized it was a habit I had picked up from basically spending too much time with a toxic person. So I stopped that. Some people go even deeper than that. And another thing I would add is that during active abuse, I got so exhausted emotionally that I literally self-isolated in that, you know, it pushed everyone who was close to me away. I couldn't handle any of their emotional issues or their drama or anything they had to talk about that wasn't positive. And people in real life have problems sometimes. And I happen to be one of those people that people come to with their problems. And so I became overwhelmed and I pushed people away. So I certainly would have seemed toxic, and I was toxic in that moment because I couldn't function like a normal human. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I definitely have seen that. And again, sometimes we call that narcissistic fleas. I would say some of that is trauma effects that come out in ways that I was just trying to survive myself. I was trying not to completely lose my mind. And since there was so much emotional energy required of me from the toxic person in my life, I felt I had no choice but to, not only was I trying to keep that person happy by trying to be whatever it was that they wanted me to be, but I was just emotionally exhausted from, even on the good days, from their excessive need for my attention. I don't know if I mentioned it before, but I have ADHD mm-hmm. on top, which I do think can be a potential trauma, but we'll talk about that another day, a potential trauma issue, but which could be connected or even caused by, but also, also I think now I'm all like distracted. This is hilarious. Also because of the fact that, you know, Dana, what was the question? I just lost myself.
Sure. It's if you're going through an intense high level of narcissistic abuse. Yeah.
Okay. That's right. I remember it. And you start to act like a narcissist, right? Yeah. So in order to survive all of that stuff and to be able to pay such serious attention, which was very difficult for me, is difficult for me consistently. And what I just did right there, that little moment where I lost what I was talking about, I think that is a residual piece of trauma. If that has happened to any of you guys, I don't know if it happens regularly, but sometimes I notice when I talk about things, personal experiences where I have gone through some things that really got to me, and I remember them in too much detail, I do what I just did and I space out for a minute and I forget. Until I remind myself, or Dana reminds me if we're on the stream. But that happens frequently. And I think that's a pretty common side effect of this type of stuff. So I thought that would be something important to share. Thoughts? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I think you touched on a lot of great things. One of which was kind of being in an abusive relationship or being out of it, realizing that, oh my gosh, there's parts of us that are dysfunctional too. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people tend to kind of think of a dysfunctional relationship in terms of kind of all or nothing. Like, okay, well, this other person, the other person, the narcissist or the alcoholic or the other, the verbally abusive person or whoever it is, they're the one with the problem, right? Mm-hmm. They're the dysfunctional one. And I am not, I'm perfectly functional. I'm just on the receiving end of that. And the reality is if we're dancing with them, we're going to get those fleas. Mm-hmm. So the only way to have a relationship with a dysfunctional person is to have a dysfunctional relationship with them. Because if we had a functional relationship with them, we wouldn't be in it. Mm-hmm. Things would be very, very different. So that's a very big aha moment. And I think a turning point in a lot of people's healing is that realization of, oh my gosh, I have all kinds of very maladaptive ways of interacting with people. And kind of here's why, here's how I picked this stuff up over the years. We all have it. We all have it. So, you know, I guess just kind of know that nobody starts off at the finish line. You know, so no matter how healthy of a home they grew up in, you can't, there is no escaping society, and society is full of dysfunction. So odds are you've got at least one thing. Most of us have dozens. And so kind of realizing, I guess taking away that judgment, because there can be a lot of shame and fear when we kind of come across this and we turn over that stone and we realize, oh my gosh, there's a lot of ways that I've been thinking and acting that are deeply dysfunctional. And what does that make me? And does that make me a narcissist? And does that make me an abusive person? And does that mean I somehow deserved it or caused it? Or, and it can really create this whole spiral. Mm-hmm. And kind of realizing at this point in time of getting clear with ourselves of getting clear from a place, ideally from a place of curiosity and not from a place of judgment about what is and isn't working for us in our life with our own behavior, and then work doing the steps needed to change it. And it's a process. That's the thing. Like we're kind of to circle all the way back around to the beginning of the live stream, we're talking about psychotherapy and narcissists. Therapy in general, it's a challenge for anybody. It is a long process, and therapy isn't something that's done to somebody, it's done with somebody. Mm-hmm. And there's only, you know, ideally some sort of skills or processing happens in a session, but it's everything that happens outside of the session that matters. So it's learning new skills and practicing them and all of that. And it just, it's a lot.
Yeah. And I think also recognizing that when you start to think to yourself, oh my gosh, look at all these problematic thinking patterns I have, and look at all these things that I haven't been doing right. Two things. First, you should remember again that you were just trying to get through that situation without losing it. And I'll put it lightly, mm-hmm. By saying losing it. And on the other side of that, most narcissists or toxic people, I should say toxic people, most toxic people do not become, okay, I'll say malignant narcissists or toxic people of the malignant nature. Okay. They don't self-reflect in that way. They don't start to ask themselves, well, wait a minute, why, you know, if they notice a problem that another person has, they're definitely going to point that out, but they're certainly not going to stop and go, wait a minute, maybe I'm the one who's the problem. And even if they can identify themselves as the problem, they will make superficial changes, and then they will just continue to blame the other person for everything else. So, I mean, yeah, that's all I would add to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to do, I know we're a few minutes over. Do you want to do one more? Do you have another question or?
I do not have one, but I would be absolutely open to doing one more.
Okay. I have one from Lynn.
Okay.
And she says her ex-narcissist has a strange relationship with his mother. He puts her above all and in an unhealthy way. What happens to a narcissist when a parent dies? So my ex-husband, I met him 1 year after his mother passed away. His father had already remarried. His mother had been very sick for a long time. She had been in a wheelchair since he was born, and she was never supposed to have babies. He was the miracle baby. It was the whole thing. And it was not good. He idealized her and sort of sainted her in a way. And I heard different things from the family about her actual level of sainthood. So I saw that, and I've seen another situation where one particular narcissist I know just spun out completely and ruined a lot of relationships. I've seen a lot of different reactions. I mean, I think it completely depends on both the level of unhealthiness in the relationship, and also it depends on the people around the narcissist at the time and how much support they can get in that time. Thoughts, Dana?
Well, the death, we're talking about death of a parent, right? The narcissistic.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
What happens when
Sorry,
a
I was
parent
trying to
dies?
scroll through the chat there for a
No
second.
worries. I understand.
The death changes everything. And in many ways, it is one of the most stressful times in a family's life. If there's ever a time where family dynamics really come into play, it's death. So, and because it's so stressful, it kind of death, when a person's dying, it tends to bring out the worst in a lot of people. So I guess kind of knowing that it can be an incredibly challenging, it's going to be an incredibly challenging time. And, you know, people handle significant amounts of stress in a wide variety of ways. So most people, well, I guess we all do, right? Like we all cope to the level of the ability that of our coping mechanisms that we have in place. So if you have somebody in your life who has already shown that they don't have a lot of adaptive coping mechanisms, they don't handle frustration and stress well. They drink, they eat, they scream, they yell, they, you know, whatever it is, then expect more of that as stressful as the stress increases.
That is entirely valid. Yep.
And if there is that level of dependence on their parent, then that's going to be very, very difficult. Because if you have an adult who has an unhealthy level of dependence upon anybody else, then odds are they don't know how to do a lot of things on their own. So they're going to have to learn all of those skills. It's just going to be very, very, very challenging for everybody involved, I guess is what I'm saying.
And I've seen, and I would totally agree with that. And I would say in my own personal experiences and in those of some clients I've worked with, what happens is a lot of times that the narcissist will then, if they're, let's say their sainted parent passes away, or let's say they will often take, and they start to do this even before that happens usually, but they'll start to put another person in that role of their caregiver or their doer if it is a situation that they are having a lot of things done by that person, which of course in most cases in my opinion would then be that person on some level has been themselves toxic and codependent with the narcissist because of the fact that they have either over sheltered or over served their child over the course of years, and their child has come to expect and be, like you said, not be able to do a lot of things on their own. Or sometimes it's even darker than that, but we'll stop there.
Actually, I have one more comment that I
Sure.
wanted to address, and this is a good one. This is from UNA, with regards to the comment from before about aren't there any common denominators with narcissists? Like they're all
Okay.
different, but aren't there common denominators? And she makes a very valid point. She says, you know, narcissistic personality disorder is a diagnosis. And just as any disorder or disease, it has symptoms by which it's diagnosed.
Course.
Those would be considered common denominators for diagnosis. Yes, absolutely. The point that I was trying to make with that is because they are all different. So some, and like the DSM, which is where we do get
Criteria.
the criteria, thank you, for making that diagnosis. It's generally a certain number of symptoms out of a list.
Yes.
And so in the list, it's although it's specific symptoms, they're also very vague.
Yes.
So that's kind of the challenging part of it is, okay, well, what, you know, how do you measure empathy? Right? What does a lack of empathy look like? Or
Right.
what does a lack of remorse look like? Well, what if the person says that they're sorry? What if they're crying? Do you see what I'm saying? So that's why I kind of gave a more general overview of it's a problematic degree of self-absorption, because
Yeah.
that kind of covers a lot of the ground there. But
Yes. I would like to, yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I'd like to add to your point. And I would, and this is a less scientific, but more practical, maybe. Look, if you look at the number of subscribers just on this channel, and then let's add in Dana's channel, and then let's add in all the other narcissistic abuse recovery channels on this platform alone, you will see that there is a reason. There are some things in common, because otherwise people would not leave me comments like, are you looking in my kitchen window? Or like, mm-hmm. have you, you know, how could you know my life? How is this exactly what I'm going through? How do you know this? Are you watching me? Or you know, most people don't say that. I always think it's funny when they say that. But, you know, people identify so deeply because whether we acknowledge it or not, there are clearly some common denominators. Otherwise, we wouldn't all be here in this moment together right now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just my personal opinion, right?
Well, okay. I mean, yeah, you're going to have dysfunctional, it's going to be dysfunction. That's the common denominator. You're going to have, but again.
But write down a phrasing and write down it, you know what I mean? Not every narcissist, mind you, but enough. But
all of that dysfunction is coming from that place of not their fault.
It's
that blinding degree of self-absorption. So when a person has that mindset of it's not my fault, there's a complete lack of accountability, then what you're going to see is all of these different defense mechanisms and dysfunctional communication, making it everybody else's fault.
Yeah.
So that's how that tends to kind of play out. And UNA makes the great point, which is what you're making too, of, UNA says, somebody asked in the chat, do narcissists throw tantrums? And she says, you know, yeah, tantrums alone do not define narcissists. Any disorder can have tantrums. Mm-hmm. Even non-disordered people can have tantrums, but yes, narcissists can have tantrums. And that's the difference here. So it's sort of like saying, all cats are mammals, mm-hmm. but not all mammals are cats. Right.
Yep. 100%.
So narcissists can have tantrums, but not all people that have tantrums are narcissists.
That's right. That's right.
Narcissists have a problematic degree of self-absorption, but not all people that have a problematic degree of self-absorption are necessarily narcissists, because we can all have problematic degrees of self-absorption at times. This is why, to be considered a personality disorder, it's the degree and frequency of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, yeah.
Yep. I absolutely agree with that. And I think that's a really valid point. Yeah. Lots of great stuff in the chat. So before we get ready to wrap up, let me say this. Wait a minute. I think it's fair to say, okay. So this is I just want to share this one comment really quick first. Empathy is only human is the name of the person who put the comment. It says, I think it's fair to say that manipulation is one of the possible tactics that could be used by such a person, but it isn't absolutely requisite. And I think that is in regard to whether or not they were master manipulators. And I think I agree with that, but the most important point that I would like to say about, the thing I'd like to say about that is that, again, those who are showing the problematic level of personal focus or whatever, those people are often manipulating, whether intentionally or otherwise, in order to get those needs met, like we talked about, but also mm-hmm. even if they're not doing it on purpose, it's still happening. So,
and it's still a problem.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
You know, and that's why, again, it goes back to us. Like, we don't have to figure out the intentionality behind what somebody's doing. We just have to figure out what works and doesn't work for us, and then set boundaries accordingly.
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
I was going to say, Jack had mentioned here in the chat too, the book, The Four Agreements, which is our book club book for the week. Mm-hmm. This Thursday at 6:30 PM, if anybody wants to join.
Over on Thrive After Abuse.
Yep.
Right here on YouTube. Go on.
Yep. And one of the things about it, one of the agreements is on not taking anything personally. And it's basically just that. It's like other people's actions are a reflection of them, not a reflection of us. And this is incredibly difficult to do when a person can cause so much destruction and pain, mm-hmm. but realize that we got caught up in the storm for whatever reason. And it's not because of you. It didn't start with you. It's not going to end with you, and you didn't deserve it, and you didn't cause it.
Yes, I totally agree. I totally agree. Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody, for being here today. And just for those of you who were not with us at the beginning, you should know that if you haven't been here before, we do this stream once a week, usually alternating channels around 12:30 Central Time, Tuesdays. You can be notified of the streams by subscribing to this channel and hitting the bell notification, and to Thrive After Abuse, Dana's channel, and hitting the bell notification. Or you can text as a backup plan, Angie Live, all one word, ANGIELIVE, to 33222, or Dana Live, all one word, to DANALIVE, to 33, nope, 22999. Say it, 22999 for Dana's. Okay. And what else? I don't know. We'll see you next week. And oh, livestreamtuesdays@gmail.com is our shared email. If you have questions you want us to answer on these streams, you can either send us an email there privately. That way we don't, your name doesn't have to show, or your screen name or whatever, and you can tell us how to refer to you. Or you can leave it in the comment section below. We will also try to check the chat for questions we missed, but it's just a lot faster if you can just leave it below when the stream goes live, or send us that email. That would be really helpful. Dana, any thoughts or questions or concerns you want to add before we wrap up for today?
No, I just thank you guys so much for all of your questions. They're fantastic. Thank you again to the Mod Squad. You guys are awesome. And if we didn't get to your questions, please email us. It's very difficult just for newcomers here. Just so we know, it's difficult for Angie and I to think and talk and read all at the same time and hunt down questions. So if we didn't get to your question, it's nothing personal. It's just our own very human limitations.
We do have a few. Thank you for Dana. That was important, and I'm glad to share that. Thank you. All right. I really do appreciate all of you here, and thank you for coming. We'll see you next week. All right.
Absolutely.
Thanks,
Okay,
Dana.
take care. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.